Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Radio Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. Today, we'll have a special report on news that former President Donald Trump is a target of the federal grand jury investigating the January 6, 2020 Capitol insurrection and a conspiracy to overturn the election results with fake electors in multiple states. Then, we'll have results of an autopsy on a young woman who died at a hospital of septic shock after being found unconscious at the Las Colinas Detention Center in Santee. The vesicular stomatitis virus, or VSV livestock disease, that's quarantined many properties in East County, has taken a surprising twist, infecting rhinos at the San Diego Zoo Safari Park, and we'll have details. Then we'll be airing part one of our candidate forum for the 4th Supervisorial District to fill the vacancy left by the resignation of Supervisor Nathan Fletcher. Hear what candidates Monica Montgomery Stepps, Amy Reichart, and Janessa Goldbeck have to say about issues including housing, homelessness, policing, and the drug crisis in our region. A fourth candidate was unable to attend. We'll be running part two of the candidate forum on our Monday show. So stay tuned for the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital.
This is Derek Wilton with the Capitol Report. Former President Donald Trump announced on July 16th that he received notice informing him that he's a target of a federal grand jury investigation into efforts to overturn the 2020 presidential election. The grand jury has been looking into the violent attack on the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021. That attack included plans by insurrectionists to halt the counting of votes and now appears tied to a conspiracy to certify fake electors from multiple states and substitute them for the real electors' votes. The U.S. Department of Justice in some states have launched probes into the fake elector scheme, with the first arrest announced in Michigan, where felony charges have been filed. Here's an update on actions in those states, according to Newsweek. Michigan's Attorney General this week filed federal charges against 16 Republican electors for forgery and conspiracy to commit election law forgery. Although Joe Biden won Michigan by 154,000 votes, or 3%, Trump supporters allegedly forged a certificate claiming they were the state's electors and sent that false certificate to the National Archives and Congress. It falsely stated that the Trump electors had met in Michigan's Capitol, when in fact only Biden's electors convened there to cast their legitimate votes. After granting immunity to 8 of the 16 fake electors in Georgia, who had signed a certificate falsely claiming to be the state's electors, a grand jury in Fulton County is expected to indict Trump and his allies in the near future. Trump may also face charges in Georgia for his calls pressuring Georgia's Secretary of State to find enough votes to give Trump victory after Biden won the state. Law enforcement in the area has been told to beef up security in anticipation of a likely Trump indictment in July or August. The U.S. Department of Justice is investigating plots in New Mexico involving 5 fake electors and in Nevada with 6 fake electors. The attorneys general in both states have said they welcome the federal probes. Special counsel Jack Smith's investigators have also met with the Secretary of State for Pennsylvania, where 20 people were allegedly fake electors. Democrats have filed a civil lawsuit against 10 allegedly fake electors. Wisconsin Congressman Mark Pocan has asked the U.S. Justice Department to investigate the alleged conspiracy. On Twitter, Trump railed against Special Prosecutor Jack Smith after learning he is a target in the January 6th election interference probe. On Truth Social, Trump called the Special Prosecutor deranged, but confirmed, "I am a target of the January 6th grand jury investigation," adding that he's been given only 4 days to report to the grand jury, Trump adding, which almost always means an arrest and indictment. Multiple major news outlets report that Smith's office has declined comment, as is customary in grand jury proceedings. It is unclear yet what charges will be filed against Trump related to the January 6th Capitol attack or related election theft conspiracy. It is unclear whether Smith may charge Trump with inciting the insurrection through his inflammatory speech at the Capitol Ellipse, in which he claimed the election had been stolen from him and urged his followers to march to the Capitol and take back our country. That speech came after 62 judges, including some appointed by Trump, ruled that there was no evidence that the election was stolen from Trump in any state. It now appears that efforts to steal the election in at least 6 states were in fact conducted by Trump supporters as part of a conspiracy to substitute fake pro-Trump electors for the real ones who cast their votes for Biden. Trump could potentially also face charges related to dereliction of duty for the nearly 3 hours during the Capitol attack when he watched the violence unfold, but did nothing to urge his supporters to stop it. Trump refused to order in the National Guard to help restore peace. It was Vice President Mike Pence who did so. To date, more than 1,000 people have been arrested for the January 6th attack, and 485 have been sentenced on charges ranging from assault to seditious conspiracy. Many of those who were convicted told courts they were inspired by Donald Trump, though proving that he intended for his supporters to become violent may be a harder charge to prove than the conspiracy to change election results. Trump might also be charged for pressuring Pence to illegally refuse to certify the votes of legitimate electors and prevent the peaceful transfer of power. The scheme, it appears, was for those votes to be substituted with the fake electors' votes in order for Trump to falsely be certified the winner by Congress. Pence refused to halt the certification of votes, and then the violent mob attacked the Capitol and sought to seize the boxes containing the real electors' votes. Several Senate aides managed to remove the boxes to safety, preserving the ballots. After the violence at the Capitol injured 140 police officers and resulted in several deaths, Congress reconvened and Vice President Pence fulfilled his constitutional duty by certifying the lawfully cast electors' votes. Trump had already been indicted on federal charges in Florida under the Espionage Act related to mishandling classified documents, as well as on criminal charges in New York State over alleged hush money payments to porn star Stormy Daniels. Though Trump is still viewed as the front runner for the 2024 Republican presidential primary, a growing number of prominent Republicans have denounced his actions as criminal charges against him mount. Those critics include Chris Christie, a former federal prosecutor and ex-New Jersey governor who is also a GOP presidential candidate. He called evidence against Trump devastating in the classified documents case, adding, "Is this the type of conduct we want from someone who wants to be the president of the United States?" Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who is also running against Trump, claimed that any indictment of the former president would be a part of an attempt to criminalize politics and try to criminalize differences, while also saying that Mr. Trump should have come out more forcefully to stop his supporters from storming the Capitol on January 6th. President Joe Biden has sought to distance himself from the probe by having Attorney General Merrick Garland appoint a special prosecutor. Jack Smith has previously prosecuted war criminals at The Hague, as well as organized crime figures for the U.S. Department of Justice. Biden has refrained from commenting on Trump's legal woes, but has criticized Trump for refusing to debate his opponents. It remains to be seen how available Trump would be for debates or other campaign events while tied up with depositions and criminal trials in multiple jurisdictions.
An autopsy has determined that 25-year-old Viana Granillo died of septic shock after she was transferred to a hospital from the Las Colinas detention facility in Santee. Septic shock is a life-threatening condition that occurs when a person's blood pressure drops dangerously low due to an infection. Treatments at a hospital may include oxygen therapy, IV fluids, medicine, antibiotics, or surgery, according to the National Institute of Health. Granillo had been arrested by sheriff's deputies on July 8th for violation of a court order. She was transferred from the Vista Detention Facility to Las Colinas that evening. 4 days later, on July 12th, about 2 a.m., deputies conducting a safety check found her unresponsive in her cell, according to Lieutenant Chris Steffen. Doses of Narcan, a drug used for suspected overdoses, were administered by deputies and medical staff, and life-saving measures were initiated. Paramedics transported her to a hospital, but her health declined and she was pronounced dead on July 13th, shortly before 3 a.m. Diana Sanchez, mother of Viana Granillo, posted more details on a GoFundMe page to help with funeral expenses. According to Sanchez, her daughter was taken to Grossmont Hospital. Sanchez wrote that her daughter had a hole in her stomach and underwent surgery, but afterwards her blood pressure dropped and she soon passed away. The medical examiner lists Granillo's death as natural causes, but it's unclear whether she was found unconscious due to septic shock or whether the infection occurred after she was hospitalized. It's also unclear whether an infection had been diagnosed or treated before she collapsed in her cell at Las Colinas. San Diego County has the highest rate of deaths in custody of any major county in San Diego for the last few years under multiple sheriffs, despite numerous steps taken aimed at reducing the number of in-custody deaths. Sanchez recalls her daughter as vibrant, eccentric, beautiful, loving, and caring, despite battling addiction. She wrote, "My daughter would give you the shirt off her back or the last dollar in her pocket just to help someone out." The Citizens Law Enforcement Review Board was notified of the death and is conducting an investigation, as is the Sheriff's Homicide Unit, which is customary with all deaths that occur in custody or with inmates who are hospitalized. Sanchez has pledged to fight for justice for her daughter. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
The outbreak of vesicular stomatitis virus, or VSV, which started in San Diego's East County in May, has since spread to six other California counties. While the disease has mostly affected horses, other equine species, and a few cattle, it has now been diagnosed in rhinos, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Darla Davis, spokesperson for the San Diego Zoo Wildlife Alliance, told East County Magazine that the VSV diagnosis has been confirmed in southern white rhinos at the safari park. Fortunately, at this time, the rhinos appear to be recovering well. VSV is being managed through robust biosecurity measures and supportive care, and all affected wildlife are expected to return to good health. White rhinos are critically endangered. The International Rhino Foundation reports that due to poaching losses, there are less than 16,000 white rhinos left in the world. All but two of these survivors are southern white rhinos, and their population worldwide has decreased by almost 12% in the past 4 years. The northern white rhino is effectively extinct, with only two females left worldwide, both in Africa. The San Diego Zoo Safari Park has frozen sperm from its last northern white rhino before it passed away and hopes to someday impregnate female southern white rhinos to give birth to northern white rhino embryos through in vitro fertilization. Thus, survival of southern white rhinos is important for both white rhino species. The local VSV outbreak does appear to be slowing down. The latest report from the USDA reports that San Diego County and the other five affected counties in California each reported just one new case in a week ending July 7th. 28 properties in San Diego remain quarantined, and 40 have been released from quarantine. Though not usually fatal, the disease causes severe blister-like lesions on the mouths, hooves, and sometimes other areas of hooved animals. The disease is contracted from bites by black flies, midges, sandflies, and other insects. VSV can also spread through shared water or feed and through contact with shared surfaces, so fly control and sanitation can help prevent the spread of the disease. There is no cure for VSV, but treatments are available for infection and to reduce discomfort, since the disease often makes it painful for animals to eat or walk. The disease can spread to humans, but generally causes flu-like symptoms such as fever and fatigue. You can find more information on VSV at usda.gov. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Derek Wilton.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the Network for Social Justice.
Welcome, everybody, to our candidate forum. This is Miriam Raftery, editor of East County Magazine and host of the East County Magazine radio show. Welcome to our candidate forum for San Diego's 4th Supervisorial District. There are four candidates running in the August 15th special election to represent this district and fill the vacancy left by the resignation of Nathan Fletcher. The district includes much of Central and South San Diego County, as well as the SDSU College area and the East County communities of Casa de Oro, Crest, Dehesa, La Mesa, Lemon Grove, Spring Valley, Mount Helix, and Rancho San Diego. And so we're honored to have candidates here today. As I say, there are four running. Unfortunately, Paul McQuigg, who's a Marine Corps veteran, just notifies us that he's traveling overseas and unfortunately could not get a connection. And we are still waiting on Janessa Goldbeck, who RSVP'd that she would participate, but is not yet here. In the meantime, we're going to go ahead and get started. So welcome to our participating candidates who are here today. Monica Montgomery Stepps, President Pro Tem of the San Diego City Council, and Amy Reichart, a private investigator and founder of Reopen San Diego. So without further ado, we're going to go to opening statements. You will each have 2 minutes to introduce yourselves, tell us a little bit about your most important experience or qualifications and your most important goals if elected. 2 minutes each. Amy, let's start with you.
All right. My name's Amy Reichart, and I've lived here in San Diego since I was 4 years old. And the reason why I'm running for county supervisor is because I've never seen things as bad as they are right now. Just in the past couple years, our population as a county has declined by 50,000. And when I've asked my friends, family, and loved ones while they're leaving San Diego County, they're saying things like, I just want to be able to afford a single family home. And that's why they're going to places like Tennessee, Texas, or Florida. They're also saying things like homelessness are way out of control. So last year, I challenged Nathan Fletcher because his failed policies have just been taking San Diego on a disastrous course. Crime is at an all-time high. We're also seeing cost of living issues, of course. And what we really need at the end of the day and what people tell me that they want is a safe, affordable place that they can enjoy with their families. So I'm here to take San Diego in a completely different direction. I do come to this race with a business mindset. I've been a successful businesswoman for the past 24 years. And in the past couple of years, I founded a successful nonprofit that was able to save thousands of city workers from getting terminated. So I'm really proud of our track record and what we've been able to do. And at the end of the day, the reason why I challenged Nathan Fletcher last year as well was some of the divisive rhetoric that he would use towards his own constituents. And so what I have led in this race so far, and I'm looking at my fellow candidates, and I respect my fellow candidates, and I'm happy to say that it's been a very civil race this so far. And I look forward to all of the questions today during the forum.
Very good. Thank you. Janessa Goldbeck has joined us. So Janessa, thank you. And I forgot to introduce our timekeeper, Branda. We can give you a 10-second warning, and then time's up, we'll say time's up, and you can finish the sentence, and we're going to try to stay on track. So next, let's hear from Monica Montgomery Stepp with your opening statement.
Thank you so much, Miriam, for organizing this. Branda, for keeping us on track with the time. My name is Monica Montgomery Stepp, and I currently serve as the city council member for District 4 in the city of San Diego and council president pro tem over the city council, which really just means that if the council president's not there, then I convene the meeting. So I'm very happy again to be here and to be running in this special election. I hope that everyone received their ballots today, or hopefully you will get them tomorrow. I grew up in the supervisorial district. Right now, I serve the community that raised me. I've been here for over 35 years. I spent my college years in Atlanta, Georgia, and came back to San Diego for law school. Since then, I have worked for 3 different elected officials and also at the ACLU leading a local campaign on bail reform. I have been elected for 5 years, and in that 5 years, I have convened the council and facilitated our budget process over the $5.2 billion budget that we have at the city of San Diego. I have also helped homeowners, first-time homebuyers, particularly of color, get down payment assistance in the entire region in the amount of $7.5 million and counting. I have also been able to institute policies and lead initiatives like the peace movement, Let's Live, Let's Love, that promotes peace in our communities. Right now in the calendar year from 2021 to 2022, in my district that I have jurisdiction over, we have seen a 9% decrease in crime and overall crime, and citywide, because of the policies that I put forward, we have seen a 65% decrease in gang violence and homicide. So those are the types of things that I'm doing at the city and want to bring to the county. The county has much larger infrastructure to deal with a lot of the issues and crises that we are facing.
Okay. Yeah, go ahead. That's time.
Okay, that's time. All right, thank you. Looking forward to the questions. Thanks so much.
That's okay. There will be closing statements. So if someone missed something important, we can throw it in at the end. Janessa, let's hear from you, your opening statement with your number one experience and qualifications.
Sure. Well, first of all, I just want to apologize for being late. Someone very close to me lost their brother to a fentanyl overdose recently, and I'm actually in the parking lot of the service right now.
I'm sorry.
Mount Helix La Mesa family, actually. So, you know, when I talk about the scale of, I'm a little bit raw right now coming in, so I apologize if I'm a little emotional, but the scale of the crisis, there were a couple hundred people here, teachers, you know, coaches, family members, friends of the family. And I just think, you know, we obviously all three of us who are in this race, the four of us are in this mix. I think we all recognize the scale of the crisis and how real it is in our community. So anyways, again, apologies for being late and not communicating, but I wanted to respect the service. For those of you I haven't met who may be watching this recording later or the live stream, my name is Janessa Goldbeck. I was born and raised here in San Diego County. My mom was a public school teacher at Vista Public Schools. My dad drove a tow truck. I was very fortunate to get to go to school in Chicago. I studied journalism and African studies. As part of my studies, I studied abroad in Uganda and Rwanda and learned that there was an ongoing genocide in the Darfur region of Sudan, not too far away. So came back to the U.S., started organizing on my campus. After college, my first chapter of my career, I worked as a human rights advocate, working to pass federal legislation to protect civilians in conflict zones. And that's really where I cut my teeth on learning how to build coalitions to get things done, even big problems in remote parts of the world. That experience brought me for the first time into direct contact with folks who served in the military. I really didn't know many growing up, although both my grandparents served in World War II, both my grandfathers. I decided to join the Marine Corps at the age of 26 to get a different side of the civilian protection experience. I think we have a lot to talk about, and I've been sort of all over the place today, but I think the number one thing I bring to this race is not only my 15 years of experience as a policy advocate, but also my deep commitment to getting things done, to moving the ball forward, not accepting the status quo as things are, and working to make a better county and a better place for all San Diegans.
Thank you so much. Homelessness is a huge issue. San Diego has one of the largest homeless populations in the nation. And now that the city of San Diego has banned homeless camps and is adding more shelters, there are some concerns that more homeless may move into East County, which already has about a quarter of the county's homeless population. In talking with homeless people and advocates for them, we've learned that some don't want to go into available shelters because of reasons such as not wanting to give up their dog or not wanting to be separated from a partner, either straight or gay, or an adult child with disabilities that their parent doesn't want to be separated. Some women say they've been assaulted in shelters and they'd rather stay on the streets where at least they can have pepper spray, you know, to defend themselves. So I would like to hear from each of you what your ideas are for helping the homeless, as well as protecting communities from problems that can be caused by homelessness, and also, would you support a study to look at innovative solutions to help those whose needs may not be being met by the existing shelters, such as maybe having a shelter with a kennel or a place where partners could stay together? Monica, we'll let you open with this one. We're going to be alternating, so everybody will get a chance to be first and last.
Yes, thank you for the question and the way that you framed it. I really appreciate that. Yes, I would support a study. I do think that there are a lot of studies out there right now. And this really is about implementation and figuring out, you know, how much money are we going to have from, you know, the federal government and state government on an ongoing basis in order to really deploy the solutions that we know.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and I just want to interject. I'm sorry, I forgot to add 3 minutes each on this question. So.
Okay. Those solutions that are tried and proven and true, which actually when you talk to advocates, but more so people who are currently unhoused, there are really a lot of good solutions on the table. You talked about the encampment ban. And so I did not support that ban for a lot of different reasons. I do have currently represent neighborhoods outside of downtown. And there's always a concern that folks would have to be driven to go to places that don't have the resources for them. Mm-hmm. And so when East Village was developed, really there were a lot of people there that either lived in single residency occupants that were torn down in order to create East Village. And there was not a plan on where the folks that were living there currently would be able to go. And so that's where a lot of the issues are coming from. And I think that needs to be confronted and when we're dealing with how to solve the problem. So, there, like you said, we could do a study, and studies are important because we have to make informed decisions.
Yeah.
But also, you know, we know what we are lacking. We know what works, right? So what we are lacking is people who are willing to and are able to work in this space, because people who are working in the space are underpaid. I think a partnership with the community colleges to gear people towards this work and also wage increases for them, it's going to help enticing folks, like, you know, doing student loan forgiveness and things like that are really going to help. Of course, we have to build. There's, you know, new innovative projects like shipping containers that are being turned into homes and that with minimal impact to the environment. There's so many things out there, but the plan, the study is good, but the plan has to be comprehensive, and it has to be detailed out so that we are implementing that plan every single day. There's so many good resources out there, but the systems that we have been paying for as taxpayers to integrate the services are not working for us. So those also need to be more robust so that people don't fall through the cracks. The last thing I'll say is everyone is not the same. Every person is different that is living on the street. Every solution is going to be different. The more case managers that we can get to walk people through these systems, the better it will be for all of us.
Very good. Thank you. Amy, let's hear your views on the homeless crisis.
So we are way beyond the point of it being a homelessness crisis. It is a humanitarian crisis that needs to be addressed right away. And so what I suggest is that we approach this with compassion. We know that a segment of our unhoused are domestic violence victims, the disabled, the elderly, our veterans, for example, and the disabled. I had a great conversation yesterday with the San Diego Rescue Mission. They've just opened up their navigation center in the North County, and I'm happy to say they have kennels for people who are unhoused. Yes, I know.
We need one in East County.
Great news. Yes. And regarding the issue of people who are disabled, this is an issue that's very close to my heart. My own father was in a wheelchair by the time I was a teenager because he had multiple sclerosis. And so I have spoken with stakeholders, but also people with lived experience on this issue. So I've spoken with the East County Transitional Living Center. I've spoken with Solutions for Change in the North County, and I've spoken with the San Diego Rescue Mission. And so when it does come to the disabled, there are places where the disabled can go. Unfortunately, there's nowhere where somebody in a wheelchair who cannot provide for themselves can go at this time. So that's something that I would address in my first 100 days. But let me just give you a big picture view of what I think needs to happen so we can really have some change here. There's also a segment of the homeless population that we must admit that the root cause of their homelessness is where severe addiction, severe mental illness and crime intersect. And so when it comes to those who are committing serious crimes, serious repeat crimes that are causing small businesses to lock their doors during the day and only open them when they see a customer wants to come in, where we're seeing coffee shops like the one in Hillcrest leave Hillcrest because they can no longer guarantee the safety of their patrons or their customers, here's what I suggest. We must absolutely require treatment, not jail, for the ones that are committing serious crimes. It is the most loving thing we can do because jails are not built, nor are they staffed to be able to care for people with severe mental illness or severe drug addiction. And of course, what we've seen in our jails is unacceptable. We've had people overdosing and committing suicide. So what I recommend is mandatory treatment for those who are committing serious crimes. We also learned a lot, according to the Alpha Project, from having unhoused people in our convention center during the pandemic. It was very controversial, but we learned we need a regional response. That's why I support the plan by Bill Walton to have a homeless triage center, a navigation center, if you will, that will be a centralized regional location where people can get shelter and then get appropriate services through different nonprofits who have evidence-based treatments and are showing results. It's not compassionate to allow people to sleep and die on our streets. So I believe in a combination of compassion and accountability will make a difference and save lives. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Amy. Janessa, let's hear from you 3 minutes on how you would address the homelessness crisis in San Diego.
Sure. And thank you again for how you framed this question, really acknowledging that there are many, many different types of people on the streets and some of them are more visible than others. And so I think when I think about this issue, as the council member said, this isn't just a one-off crisis. We know that we have a perpetual need for services and additional housing for people because the state of California has a real lack of affordable housing. In fact, rents in San Diego are now higher than they are in San Francisco. So for most people are maybe just a paycheck or a catastrophic illness away from losing their housing. So as much as we need to do to stem, to address the crisis on our streets, we need to think about this as a perpetual need and think about the whole continuum. So I'll start with emergency shelters. As you pointed out, there are a lot of different types of folks on the streets who need a lot of different types of shelter. And the reality is that we don't even have enough beds to meet the current need. So the county can really step up and play a role by helping to open shelters that meet diverse sets of needs using its own land and bringing in service providers to do that. Whether that's seniors who need additional help because they can't meet their activities of daily life on their own, or people with animals, or people who are in same-sex relationships, or people who have small kids with them. They all have very, very different needs. And so I think we need to do a little bit of everything everywhere and all at once. Open up our lands, think about how we can get to yes on more facilities that can address unique populations. Second, we have an absurd reality, which is that we're using our county jails as our largest mental health service provider in the region. And our region is currently short approximately 700 psychiatric beds. There was a study done recently that showed over the next decade, we're going to need an additional 18,000 behavioral health workers, that's psych nurses, addiction counselors, social workers, to meet the scale of the need. So the county really needs to invest in finding a way to be able to fund that and treat it as the crisis that it is, really prioritizing, making sure that we're hiring the behavioral health workforce we need and working aggressively with the federal, state, and local government to open more psychiatric beds. Finally, there's the prevention piece. As I mentioned earlier, we know rents are way too high and a lot of people are very close to being on the brink. So the county currently has a pilot program where they provide a couple $100 a month to landlords who've had to raise their rents because of inflation. And so the seniors who are on a fixed income, currently just over 200 seniors are enrolled in this program. They're able to stay in their home even though the rent has gone up and the landlord's able to get their market rate rental value. And so I'd like to see that program expanded to more populations and made permanent. I mean, that's going to require, really being aggressive about what sort of funding we go after, working with our state partners to write legislation that funds this as a perpetual need. But I think those are three tangible things the county can do to make a difference.
Thank you very much, Janessa. On to our next question, and we'll give you 2 minutes each on this one, trying to get as many questions in as we can. Housing. San Diego is one of the highest cost housing markets in the nation. And while the county has made some strides toward building more housing, multifamily housing, a lot of it still is not truly affordable. Efforts to build more homes have run into problems of their own, such as judges who have blocked sprawling rural projects due to fire evacuation concerns, you know, traffic so people can get out. And when high-rises are built in residential areas, then neighbors are complaining of parking problems and blocking sunlight and increasing traffic jams on surface streets in places like Spring Valley. So I would like to ask each of you what approaches you support to meet our region's housing need, especially affordable housing, while addressing, you know, the concerns of all of the residents. Amy, I think it's your turn to go first on this one.
Well, I'll be the first one to say, yes, oh my gosh, San Diego is not affordable. I can remember just 10 years ago when my husband and I were able to buy a home and we looked at homes in our price range. We were showed homes next to freeway on-ramps, under freeway overpasses, and next to electrical substations. I'm very glad that we were able to buy an old hoarder house and we have rebuilt it with our own hands. It's a very difficult market here in San Diego because it's very desirable. Everybody knows that. But there's some things that I believe that the government is doing that's getting in the way of sensible building. Let me just give a for example. What happened was when we capped building of single family homes right here in San Diego County, what we saw was massive sprawl being built in Southern Riverside, so Temecula. So now what we have are people who live in Temecula, Murrieta, and they are commuting every day to San Diego, which is not helping our environment. So those are the unintended consequences of not building sensibly. Now, let me just say, I'm against sprawl, 100%. I would never want anything built that would put our firefighters in danger or be a wildfire risk to people in the county. But we're also seeing, as I mentioned earlier, how 50,000 people have left the county, and many of them are saying that they want affordable housing. I want to conclude by saying I don't believe that SB 10 is the solution to our housing problems, and here's why. SB 10 allows for the bulldozing of single-family homes, and in its place, a very dense apartment unit is built, and these units are typically not for sale. These are for rent. And of course, all we're seeing is every year the rents just keep going up. So again, we want to be able to build things that people actually want, like affordable single family homes. But instead, what SB 10 does is it's bulldozing the existing housing stock that we have, and it's going to make the price of a single family home go up. So what I would suggest is sensible building that is environmentally sensitive to the wildfire concerns and escape routes also in the county, to be built in the eastern parts of our unincorporated county, but also in the southeastern parts of our county. People just want a safe place, affordable place that they can live. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much for that. Janessa, go ahead and answer the housing questions.
Both are very important. So, you know, to me, this is the issue of our time here in San Diego County. It is the underpinning of our homelessness crisis. It's the underpinning of, our losing jobs to other regions because we don't have workforce housing. And it's incredibly important that we try to get to yes in a way that both meets our housing goals and our climate goals on projects. And I'm very proud to be endorsed by our county firefighters. I don't believe in building in high wildfire areas. This obviously led to a lot of major issues in both our county and our state with increasingly hot summers and increasingly extreme fires. So that's really important. But I do think that the County Board of Supervisors has the opportunity to really ensure that our county in the unincorporated areas, eastern southern parts of the county, are doing everything we can to meet our state mandated housing goals. And right now, we're nowhere close to meeting those, which is why we continue to have such high costs for housing, both rentals and for purchase. So one of the ways that I think we could do that is maximizing areas that are already have already been developed in the unincorporated areas, places that have urban cores, established job sites, schools, homes, places like Lakeside, Spring Valley, Rancho San Diego that are looking for an investment in infrastructure. I was out in Rancho San Diego recently and talking to community members there, and they were talking about the state of their roads and their lack of public transit. For too long, the Board of Supervisors has treated the unincorporated parts of the county as sort of the stepchild to the urban center of San Diego. And I think we need to flip the script on that and start putting our money where our mouth is. If we say we're serious about solving the housing crisis, we have to build more housing. And there's a lot of communities out there who would love the investment of mass transit, would love the investment of additional resources to help their communities thrive.
Thank you. Monica, let's hear from you on the housing crisis.
Okay. Just, you know, this is, as you, when you frame the question, Miriam, there is a lot of resistance on all sides to housing, yet there's also a lot of resistance to homelessness. And I see there's an intersection there, right? So we have to be able to be a place where people can raise their families and people can live here, or we will have more people on the streets. Now, not everyone is on the street because of an economic issue, but a recent study just came out that said that the majority of people that are on the streets are because of an economic issue. And that means they cannot afford housing here. So I say all this to say that these votes that I have taken for more housing have been very, very tough votes. Because community members do not, there's a lot of fear about seeing the character of the neighborhoods change. But I say, and I, you know, will say here and continue to say that this is the issue of our time, and it is impacting every other crisis that we are seeing in the county. We have to be able to provide more housing. So there are a lot of things that we can do. We can provide better departmental permitting. We can prioritize building affordable housing in higher resource areas so that we have a balance across the entire region. There are HUD regulations that require us to spread housing out, especially affordable housing, so that we're not building pockets of poverty, right? And we don't want the East County to experience that imbalance. You know, we want to have balanced housing across the entire region. So I support inclusionary housing. I support the possibility of ADUs being used for home purchase. That is something that is a conversation at the state right now. So we have to attack it from all levels for our lower to moderate income folks that are here and want to stay in San Diego and keep their talent within our region.
Very good. As Janessa so eloquently pointed out, we have a drug crisis in our county right now. A new Sandag study just out the past week or so shows that 60% of the people arrested in our county jails are on methamphetamines, and many of them are on other drugs. Fentanyl is also the number one cause of death in county jails, but beyond that, fentanyl deaths have risen something like 900% in the general population as well, affecting people like Janessa's friend. So I'd like to ask each of you, what needs to be done to prevent drug abuse and help those with addictions? And I would add, I believe supervisors recently declared a fentanyl crisis. Do we need to extend that to include methamphetamines as well? Janessa, we'll let you go first on this one.
Sure. Well, we know that fentanyl is the leading cause of death for adults in this country now, under the age of 45. That is an insane statistic. And I think, you know, I mentioned earlier how deeply personal this issue is to me, and I'm sure to all of us who have had an experience with it. A couple of things. One, we know that the county is about to receive $100 million in settlement resources from the opioid crisis. And that those funds can go directly into our community to be used to both prevent fentanyl from getting into our community and treat and help people who are already addicted. So a couple of different things. Narcan is a nasal spray, which can reverse the effects of an overdose. I would like that to be available as frequently in the general public as AEDs are, defibrillators for folks having a heart attack. There's no reason that every restaurant, every bar, every school shouldn't have access to that in a very accessible way, because it can save a life. And I fundamentally believe that is a very tangible thing the county can do right away. Second, we know that drugs are making their way into our jails and that people are dying in our jails as a result. And so some of those opioid funds I'd like to be able to put into resourcing our law enforcement partners to be able to make sure that drugs are not entering our jails. And finally, I'm proud to say I'm endorsed by the folks on the front lines of this crisis, our deputy DAs and our investigators. They have a lot of ideas about things that they can do in our community to help find drug dealers and hold them accountable. And I would want to work hand in hand with them to make sure that dangerous drug dealers are taken off of our streets.
Okay, very good. Monica, how would you address the drug crisis, including both fentanyl and methamphetamines, which, you know, apparently is an enormous problem?
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, first of all, I want to say condolences to you, Janessa. Thank you for being here. We know that you're very strong and a trooper. And so thank you so much for being here. I do think that with the $100 million or so dollars that the county will be receiving, that education is a big, big component of this. We've worked with a lot of nonprofit organizations, especially those that are raising kids. Grandparents Connection, for example, is one of them that had the ability to educate grandparents, parents, aunts, uncles, and young people about the severe nature of fentanyl. I think that that's very, very important. But I also think that we have to be able to have facilities now for people who know that they need help and want help. And we are lacking in that as well. So we need additional treatment facilities. Enforcement is a part of this, right? And I know there's been a lot of conversation from the state on down as to how do we balance enforcement, just trying to avoid what happened during the war on drugs, because we know during the war on drugs, we put a lot of people into a system that still they had to come out of, and they did not have the capacity to make it and reenter themselves into society. So we just created and kicked a problem down the road. This is a public health crisis, and it has to be treated as such. So I think a balance between education, enforcement, and beefing up our treatment facilities is extremely important. Lastly, I would just want to agree on the Narcan issue, and also to have some type of qualification for nonprofit orgs is important too. We put it on the MTS transit line with our security folks there, and it's just very, very important.
Amy, go ahead.
So how I come at this is I was a Celebrate recovery leader, and I've led thousands of people into treatment and recovery. But when it comes to fentanyl, all it takes is one time to take a life.
Yeah.
And as we've seen in the county, children as young as 13 have died. I'm absolutely for distributing more Narcan, making it available at restaurants and also schools. However, as we know, it only takes one time to take a life. And the source of fentanyl is it's coming over our border. And so although this is a federal issue, it does affect the county. And so what it's really going to take is a county supervisor who is going to stand up, protect our kids, and demand action from our federal government. Because right now there's been a 300% increase of fentanyl over our borders that they've confiscated since 2020. And as we know, it only takes a little. So I'm a big proponent of treatment and not punishment. But also when it comes to treatment, we've seen over the past 150 years that what we really still need to have are loving bottom lines. So it's perfectly fine to say to somebody who has overdosed repeatedly in an emergency room, the best place for you right now is mandatory treatment. We want to help you before you become another statistic. When it comes to law enforcement locally, yes, we would always want to hold a drug manufacturer or someone who makes or sells a product liable and possibly criminally responsible if their product resulted in the death of another human being. And so, yes, we do need to strengthen our laws. And I support DA Summer Steffen's plan to strengthen our laws against fentanyl dealers and suppliers. Thank you.
Thank you, Amy. Moving on to policing, we've touched on this a little bit. The sheriff oversees law enforcement in our unincorporated areas, and yet some of the unincorporated areas have very long response times, even for serious crimes. Other issues, of course, are the high number of jail deaths, and in the urban areas, concerns over equity and accountability by law enforcement. So I'm going to make this just kind of an open-ended question. What would each of your priorities be regarding law enforcement and specifically the sheriff's department? I believe it is Monica's turn to go first on this one.
Sounds good. I just want to say, first of all, in my current position, and I served as the chair of public safety and livable neighborhoods committee for 4 years as a city council member. And in those 4 years, I supported raises, wage increases for police officers. I supported lateral bonuses. I supported down payment assistance for police officers so that they can live in the neighborhoods that they serve. And so there are a lot of things that I supported. But I also was really vocal and will still be vocal about accountability. I understand that we have to be staffed up in order for law enforcement officials to do their job. And I definitely understand that. I also know that there's a disparity in the way that people are treated depending on where they live, how they identify, what they look like, right? And so there are things that we have to address, I think, as a nation, a state, and as a region, but it does not forgo the responsibility that we have to fund law enforcement, right? So I approach it from both ends. I think that there are many communities that have different experiences with law enforcement officers, and that needs to be acknowledged and addressed. And the more that we can deploy the services more equitably, the better it is going to be for our entire region. We have one of the highest rates of jail deaths in San Diego County in the entire state. And that has to be addressed. Some of it is a staffing issue. Some of it is an accountability issue. And I will continue to address those as I have done in my last 5 years.
Okay, thank you very much. Amy, let's hear your views on policing.
Last year, I did a ride along with a 25-year veteran of the San Diego Police Department. And what he told me as we drove past some of the homeless encampments where nearly 100% of the people that live in the encampments are struggling with severe addiction. He also went on to say that Proposition 47, which was passed by the voters, which made stealing less than $900, something that was less serious, more of a civil citation rather than a criminal act, has called what he says lawlessness. What's happening is people stealing less than $900 from businesses. There's now organized crime rings that are going into these businesses and carefully calculating to steal just under $900. And of course, this goes hand in hand with the homeless encampments because it also fuels some people's drug addictions as well. And so one of my major platforms has been public safety. This year in April, the San Diego Police Officers Association awarded me an honorary badge patch, the same one that San Diego police officers wear on their sleeves when they're on the beat. And they did it to thank me for saving their jobs in 2021. And so what we've seen as a result, we've had a huge understaffing in the sheriff's department as well. And we're understaffed by 250 deputies at this time as morale is at an all-time low. And many of these officers are good people. Yes, we have to make sure that we hold the bad ones accountable, but we have to remember the good people that are serving and protecting us, and we need to reward them and make sure that they're able to afford to live in this county. I just want to conclude that the latest SANDAG numbers are not good that were just released in May. We're seeing a 10% increase in robberies. We're seeing an 8% increase in violent crimes against senior citizens. And horrifically, we're seeing a 9% increase in hate crimes. So what I believe what we need to do is support the good police, the good deputies that are protecting us, and make sure that they're able to get their numbers up so we can reduce those call times in the unincorporated county and also be able to stem this new wave of crime. Thank you.
Thank you, Amy. Janessa, could you please share your views on policing issues and what your priorities would be?
Sure. Well, I served for 7 years in the Marine Corps as a combat engineer officer, but I also had a collateral billet as a uniformed victim advocate. And in that role, my job was to help service members who had experienced sexual assault navigate the system, whether that was a criminal investigation or simply seeking care and services. And being exposed to the military's system of investigating and prosecuting these crimes made me very aware of how deeply flawed it was. And I became an outspoken advocate for accountability and change because the system was leaving too many people vulnerable and too many people without justice truly being served. And I continue to be an outspoken advocate for reforms, dramatic reforms to that system as the leader of a national veterans advocacy organization today. And I'm telling that story to illustrate that I'm very proud of my Marine Corps service. I'm very proud of being a Marine, but I think it's incredibly important to hold every organization accountable. And given that the San Diego County jail deaths are some of the highest in the state, it's incredibly important that our supervisors are holding the sheriff accountable to fixing the problem. And I know that the state has conducted an audit and made a series of recommendations. It would be my prerogative to hold monthly check-ins with the sheriff. That on the flip side of that is making sure that our sheriffs and our deputies have the resources they need. I went on a ride along a couple of weeks ago out in East County in the unincorporated area, and they were down 2 squad cars because they just didn't have the manning to be out there. We responded to a domestic violence call. It took us 30 minutes to get out there just because of how deep it was in the rural parts of the mm-hmm. county. And I understand how terrifying that is for people who live there and want to make sure that if something is happening, that there is law enforcement there to handle it and to do so in a safe manner. So we absolutely need to pay people competitive wages. We need to invest in telling good stories about law enforcement officers that are doing great things in our community so that it is an attractive career choice for people so that we can recruit officers from the communities that they're serving in and make sure that they can afford to live there as well.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you very much. And I do applaud those of you who've gone along on the ride along. I think it's a great way to really learn more and see what the problems are firsthand.
That's the end of part one of our candidate forum, and we will be airing part two of the hour and a half forum on our show Monday. So please tune in, and you can also find the entire forum with video posted at eastcountymagazine.org.
A free press is the foundation of our democracy. KNSJ Radio is dedicated to providing nonprofit news in the public interest, not special interests. We rely on your support to continue bringing you important stories from San Diego and East County that you won't hear anywhere else. Please make a generous donation at knsj.org to sustain KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, AK Jewel, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine radio show.